I made this wonderful PowerPoint. Well, I can tell you it was a wonderful PowerPoint because I can't find it and you're not going to see it. So, but a long time ago, I had seen this picture that I very roughly drew on the board over here. And it's my plan, which is straight across, and it's God's plan that goes up and down like this. And so that's what I'm going to talk to you about today, are the ups and downs of God's plan in my life. So over the last 4 years, I've asked a lot of people to come tell their story. So today is my day. I'm going all the way back to the, like the Sound of Music, you know, let's go to the very beginning, a very good place to start. So I was born in Alamo, Tennessee, a town of 2,500. Probably, yes, Doris, I will get to that. probably wasn't 2,500 then. But in 1970, when I was the one who was hired to take the census in Alamo, Tennessee, on one half of the town, and another lady took the other half of the town, we came up with exactly 2,500 people in a town, in a county of 14,900. So you can tell I didn't grow up with a lot of things around me. My parents met in high school, and they married after Daddy came back from World War II. There were six boys in my dad's family, and they all served. Five out of the six, the five oldest ones, were all in service at the same time during World War II. I think there's a rule against that now. I have a book that my grandmother wrote notes in, and on one page, I mean, it's like an old farmer's almanac kind of thing, but she, on blank pages, she wrote notes. And so on Christmas 1943, three or 44, she put JB and where he was, Roy and where he was, Harry and where he was, PB, Paul Burke, my dad, with a question mark, Toby and where he was. So they knew where four out of five of their sons were. They got a telegram one day saying that my dad had been injured, and they didn't hear anything else for 3 months. They didn't know whether he was had died, was clinging to life, was, they didn't even know what country he was in. Finally, my grandfather went to Fats Everett, who was the U.S. representative for West Tennessee, and said, my wife is going to worry herself to death if we don't find out something about our son. And he did, his office did some checking and found out that he had been wounded in the shoulder. The bullet, they left it in his arm. He died with the bullet still in his arm. And that he was back on the field fighting the war again. So he came home. You know, it was one of those things. Every time my brother and I would ask him questions about the war or some discussion would come up with the war, my mother would say, I don't want to hear about it. So Dick and I have grieved after our dad died because we know very little about what happened during World War II and his part of that. So my parents married. My brother was born about a year later, and I was born about 2 years after him. And there's a lot more I can tell you about him. But my dad was a quiet man. He adored his family. He was the rock of not only our family, but his family and my mother's family. Of the Alamo Church of Christ, which is where I know Doris from. Her husband grew up at the Alamo Church of Christ, D. I will tell you that it's COVID in Crockett County. They got busy somewhere, flucy somewhere along the way, and changed it to COVID. So, but technically, the last name is COVID. So, that's right. My dad was a rural mail carrier for 37 years. He had the same heavy-duty, long route. He drove 74 miles a day and serviced 300-and-something mailboxes. He knew everything that went on around on his route. He knew when anything was not quite right. There were more than one time, several times through the years, was always when he would realize there's something not right there, and he'd get out and go check on it and find out someone was sick or whatever. He had one man on his route that Daddy did all of his business. The man would come down, walk down to the to the mailbox and meet Daddy, and he'd say, I need for you to go to the bank and see Mr. Herbert. Now, that was Mr. Herbert Perry, who was the president of the bank, and tell him I need to borrow $800 or whatever to get my crops in this year. And Daddy would say, okay. He'd come back, go to the post office, finish up, go to the Bank of Alamo, say, tell Mr. Herbert that this, I can't remember his name, but this gentleman needed so much money. And Mr. Herbert would say, okay. And he'd sign something, give it to Daddy, and Daddy'd go get the money and take it back to the man the next day. So he comes out one day and he says, tomorrow, after you finish your route, can you come back and pick me up? And Daddy said, well, is there a problem? He said, no. I bought a truck. I need for you to go pick me up. I need for you to take me to pick it up. Daddy was like, I'll be right here to pick you up. So he was, he was, like I said, a mail carrier for 37 years. He went by the thing of neither snow nor ice or whatever or dark of night will keep you from delivering the mail. I watched him put chains on his tires many times to get the mail out. One of the things that I didn't realize until I was older was, on Christmas morning, we would get up and Dick and I would see what Santa Claus brought us. And while Mother fixed Christmas breakfast, or breakfast, it wasn't, I mean, it just happened to be on Christmas, Daddy would leave and go to the post office because there was always a delivery from Memphis on Christmas, on every morning. And he would go, and there were two rural carriers. He and Rupert both would go, and they'd go through any packages and pull them out and take them out to the houses on Christmas morning because they didn't want some child not to get their Santa Claus. So that's the stock I come from the fuel side. Then there was my mother, who her high school basketball coach called her Bouncer, and she had that personality. So she was outgoing and involved in anything that she thought her family needed for her to be involved in. She was a Sunday school teacher, a Girl Scout leader, the PTA president, and she led the fundraising efforts to air condition our school when no other public school in Tennessee was air conditioned because we lived in cotton country. And we started to school the week after the 4th of July. We went until the middle of September, we got out until the 1st of November, and we literally went to the fields and picked cotton during that time. It was not, there was nothing fun about it. If you ever think, well, they got out in the fall, well, we got on the back of a pickup truck, real safe, from one farm or another. And we picked cotton, and then we went back to school about the end of October. When I was 10, Mother and two of her friends decided that if they were going to educate their children like they wanted us to be educated, that they were going to need to go to work. The only factory had in Alamo was called Southern Foundation, and they made bras and girdles. And that was just a little bit below Mother and Tommy and Annette's standards. They just couldn't see themselves going and sitting at a sewing machine all day making bras and girdles. So they decided instead that they would enroll at Lambeth College in Jackson, Tennessee, and get their degrees and then see where that took them. So at the age of 38, my mother started to college. She'd never had a day of college. She started to college, graduated with honors in 3.5 years, and then she went to work for the Real Fruit Girl Scout Council and traveled 9 counties teaching Girl Scout leaders and about how to be a Girl Scout leader and how to run a day camp. After doing that for 4 or 5 years, she was hired as the history and economics teacher at Alamo High School. And she did that, she resigned in, keyword, resigned in May before she turned 62 in August. And people would say, well, Katie Sue, I didn't know you were old enough to retire. Oh, I'm not. I'm not old enough to retire. I mean, she missed it by 3 months or something, you know, as far as Social Security is concerned, but she would have never admitted that. She might have been just a little bit vain. So she also sold real estate. She was the one that all the kids, not all of them, but a lot of the kids that she had taught, when they started to buy houses, they'd come see Miss Katie Sue. And when they didn't have quite enough money for the down payment or didn't have quite enough money to buy the house that they wanted, well, she didn't need her commission anyway. So she would make a deal and either get less commission or I don't know how many times she made no commission. So my dad died of sudden cardiac death syndrome. 1995, very suddenly, as it says, he came in, he'd been out working in the yard, came in and sat down in a chair and died. So he was 79 years old. And my mother, we talked to her about moving to Middle Tennessee, knowing full well that that was never going to happen. She wasn't going to leave Alamo. So she said, no, I'm staying right here, and I'm going to continue to be involved. And then we're home one weekend, and Mother said to my brother Dick and me, I need to talk to y'all. I've been encouraged to run for mayor, and I think I'm going to do it. So she's 74 years old, and she decides maybe she'll just run for mayor against the 20-year incumbent, by the way. She lost by 11 votes. My brother said the night of the election, well, if I'd known it was going to be that close, I could have bought that many. And probably he could have. So, when I was 3, we built a house on, well, it was actually on Gin Street. But it was changed to East Park Street a few years later when a Baptist from Chicago moved down the street from us, and he said the only gin his friends in Chicago knew about were the kind that he drank, that you drank, and he was a good Baptist, and he just thought that was offensive. I wonder why he didn't just go buy a house on Main Street or somewhere, but he got a petition, and it was changed to Park Street. There were two farmers. One raised cotton, one had prize-winning Hampshire hogs, and they decided they would cut a street down through the middle on their property lines and sell lots on either side. It was right after World War II. It was in the early 50s, and every family, or almost every, I guess every family that bought a lot during that time, had all the men had come back from World War II. They'd gotten married, they started families, and they all built houses on what was to become East Park Street. To this day, there's still a cotton field behind the house where I grew up. Behind the houses on the other side of the street, they had prize-winning Hampshire hogs. But thankfully, they moved them to the farm pretty soon after we moved to that neighborhood. There were 30-plus children in a 6-year age range within 1/4 mile. I mean, it was everybody, all my friends, if they were predicting snow, my friends who didn't live on Park Street, They were calling, can I come spend the night with you? Because you wanted to be on Park Street during the summer and during the fun times. There were so many children when it snowed, and it didn't snow real often, but when it snowed, that either my dad or one or two of the other dads that were along that street would go to the city hall, get street clothes signs, and just close off the street because to keep us from one of us getting killed or having a wreck, or somebody having a wreck or something. My mother, after she ran for mayor, found out about a year later that she had stage 4 ovarian cancer. And she said, when I look back, I know God knew I would need my energy to fight cancer, and I wouldn't have time to be mayor of Alamo. So, when I was, what are my notes here? We basically had a huge playground is what we had. And right up over the hill from our house, it wasn't a very big hill, trust me, it was the school. So you started at one end of the school in the first grade, and you graduated out in the gym out on the other end and when you finished high school. So when I was a small child in kindergarten and first grade, I had a speech problem. I had an articulation problem. I didn't talk plain. I know y'all find that hard to believe. But my parents drove me. My dad normally would pick me up after school on Wednesday afternoon, and we would drive to Jackson, which at that time was about an hour drive, to take me to the West Tennessee Speech and Hearing Center for Miss Washington. And within a year or a year and a half, The people who had said, let your mother talk, let me talk to your mother, you know, is there someone else who can tell me what you're trying to say? I hated those people. They they could all understand me, and as is obvious, I haven't quit talking since. So, we were involved in church 3+ times a week. We were involved in scouts. We were involved in school activities. And when I was 10, three of my friends and I decided we wanted to go to Girl Scout camp. And our parents or our mothers talked about it, and they decided that since none of us had ever been to camp, that we probably didn't need to go to a 2-week overnight camp. So they started looking for another camp for us. We had, out of the four, one was Baptist, one was First Christian, one was Methodist, and then there was me from the Church of Christ. Mid-South Youth Camp from Freda Hardeman had not started by that time. So one of my friend Kitty, her mother, they were Baptist, she said, there's a Baptist girls camp at Linden, Tennessee. You go on Monday morning and you come home, they come home on Friday noon. So they signed us up and we went. We went to, we were in two rooms. Carol and I were in one room, and Kitty and Sissy were in the other room. We had to get up at 6:15 every morning, make our beds, get dressed, make our beds, and at 6:30 have a devotional with some member of our group. So we said, well, this will be nice. We'll just have devotionals with each other. On Wednesday night, the counselor, Brooksy, said to me after dinner, Paulette, will you have your devotional with me in the morning? Well, you know, I'm 10. I hadn't developed a real smart mouth at that time, so I said, well, of course, you know. So we did, and we talked and everything, and we prayed, and then I went on back to camp and went home on Friday and never thought about it again. About, I guess, 10 days later or so, Brother Adams, John Adams, that some of y'all may know, Greg Adams, who taught at Lipscomb Academy for several years. He was our preacher then. And he called and told Mother and Daddy he'd like to come over and talk to them. So we're out, Dick and I are outside playing in the neighborhood, playing kick the can, doing whatever outside, and Brother Adams comes. So the next, Mother and Daddy don't say anything. The next morning we get up, I get dressed, I'm headed out the door to go play, and she says, Paulie, wait just a second, I want to talk to you. So I said, okay. And she said, did anything happen while you were at camp? No. Why? And she said, well, Brother Adams came last night and he was concerned because he got a letter saying that you were saved while you were at Baptist camp. My mother couldn't wait to sign me up for Girl Scout camp the next year. So. Trust me. When I was 13, one Sunday night, Alison Richardson, somebody, she has a married name now, that more, said to me, there are some of us that are going to be baptized Sunday night. And we've talked about it. Do you want to do that? And I said, yeah. So it never occurred to us to tell our parents we decided we'd be baptized. So they start the invitation song, and all six of us go down the aisle. And it also never occurred to us that there was one man's baptismal garment and there was one woman's baptismal garment. I was the last one who was baptized and almost drowned from the weight of the clothes I had to wear to be baptized. My mother reminded me many times after that, if you had just told us, we could have been prepared for this, you know. We had a great youth group. We had as I said, 14,000 people in our county. There were 10 Churches of Christ. We were the most liberal, which is a joke to say we were the most liberal. But we actually paid a song leader. We had a youth group, and people from other who went to other churches on Sunday morning would come to Alamo on Wednesday night so they could be part of the youth group. And it was just, you know, our lives revolved around school and church and all that was going on. At Alamo, you started literally in the one end of the school, and you graduated 12 years later at the other end of the school. You just went through the whole place. I graduated in a class of 37 students. I was a cheerleader and a majorette, and I was voted most school-spirited and wittiest in my class. I wasn't in the valedictorian, but I was in the top five. So the first summer after I graduated, I worked at the Milan Army Ammunition Plant. I literally made mortar shells on the assembly line. My job... I had the personality. My first job on that was on the assembly line, and I took this little disc thing and I put it down onto a metal post in a mortar shell. And the guy that was the supervisor over that reminded me at least three times a day, if you don't do that right, you could blow up the whole place. I don't really think that was true. But I will tell you that at the Marlin Army Ammunition Plant, I think there were four different lines. They were a half a mile apart and had huge mounds of dirt between them because literally at any time, one of them could have blown up. So after about 2 weeks, I guess, my cousin and I both were working there, and this guy comes and gets us, and he says, "Hey, blondies, come with me." You got a lot of respect at the Violent Ammunition Plant. So we went with him. He took us out to this little shed that was behind there, and we're just kind of like, we're not sure about this. And he told us our new job was that they were bags, they were about this long and about this big around, and you took them and you put them up in this machine and you filled them with black soot. And then you sealed them off and you threw them in a box. We could make 6,000 a day. We were good at this, let me tell you. That was actually what they used. This is my understanding. So the mortar shell would go all the way down, everybody to do their part, and you get to the very end, and they would go into an inner casing, and then an outer casing, and between the two casings, they put these soot bags in. That was the cushion for them. It also was the thing that when they were fired, supposedly our soldiers knew that the black smoke knew there was a mortar shell incoming. Don't know about that, but I did my job and filled the soot bags. I also got my lifeguard certification that summer and spent the next 3 years being a lifeguard at the Crockett County Country Club. So I chose Lipscomb to go to college. I considered Freda Hardeman for about this long. Nothing wrong with Freda Hardeman at all. It's a great school, but it was a little too close to home, and my brother had gone to Lipscomb. I had friends that I already knew at Lipscomb, people I already knew at Lipscomb, so I came to Lipscomb. I got a degree in communications, and then I came back, and then I moved to Memphis to get my master's in speech and language pathology. I wanted to be like Miss Washington. I wanted to be able to teach children to talk plainly. That was my goal. I was in Memphis for 2 years. And I prayed the whole 2 years that God wouldn't make me live in Memphis the rest of my life. Just wasn't my place. I mean, I'd grown up 75 miles away. No offense, Sue. I'd grown up 75 miles away, and that's where we always went for special things, you know. But that wasn't for me. I wanted to get back to Nashville. So I came back. I went to work for Metro Schools as a speech therapist. My first year, I had, in the first month, I had three different schools, two in the Donaldson area and then West End Middle School, which was a junior high school at that time. I had tested over 700 children for speech and hearing and had walked up and down hallways and just trying to do my job. And my supervisor came, and there's one of the principals, his name was Donald Harned. And so Ms. Adams went in and she said, "Well, Mr. Harned, how's the new speech therapist doing?" And he said, "Well, she seems nice, but she hasn't put up a bulletin board all year." So Ms. Adams went out into her car and came in with a coloring book. And they were on each there were, it was, I guess, 12 pages and had a picture for each month. She said, the first time you're here each month, have them color the picture and put it on the bulletin board, and you won't have to listen to Donald Harned. I said, okay, that's fine with me. So I soon started praying. I prayed God wouldn't make me live in Memphis. Then I started praying that he wouldn't make me be a speech therapist with Metro Schools for the rest of my life. I left there, and I went to work. Now, this is a stretch. I went to work as the Director of Fairs, Special Project, and Public Information for Tennessee Department of Agriculture. In case you're wondering, or you might be suspicious, that would be a political appointment. My mother had been involved in the Alexander campaign. I had Randall Richardson's dad had been very involved, and someone that Carrie knows. And so they called up the local state representative, and he said, let me see what I can do. Jerry Griggs from Humboldt, Tennessee, 12 miles down the road from Alamo, was the commissioner. I loved it. I traveled all over Tennessee. I went to county fairs. I went to the Mid-South Fair. I went to the Tennessee State Fair. I went to the Appalachian Fair in Upper East Tennessee. I walked through cow barns and pig barns and judged corn and judged pies and acted like I knew what I was doing. And I would talk to my dad, and I would say, Daddy, I was in the barn today, and they had this cow, and I would describe it, and Daddy would say, oh, that was a Jersey, or that was, or whatever. I didn't know about this stuff. But one of the nicest parts of the job was that I was the liaison with the 4-H and FFA groups across Tennessee. And one of the things I found out was that the 4-H had twice as many kids involved as FFA, and they got four times as much money from the state of Tennessee. And the FFA group had kind of taken me under their wings, and I hosted a breakfast, or the Department of Agriculture commissioner hosted a breakfast each year in Kansas City for their annual national convention. And so I'd gotten to know them. So I went to the commissioner and said, they have this many and they have this many, but the money's not, doesn't add up right. And it was a good year for the state of Tennessee, and he said, well, let's double their money. So I became the hero of the Future Farmers of America. And I'm probably the only person y'all know who was given, and this is, I'm serious about this, was a great honor. I was awarded the Tennessee Honorary Farmer Award, and I was honored, and I was given the National Honorary Farmer Award. And I did okay. And then I was asked to be as part of the horse judging contest at the National FFA Convention. I had no clue what I was doing there, but I just kind of followed along with the rest of them, and it was great. I stayed at the Department of Agriculture. I was there for about 3.5 years until we changed commissioners. Commissioner Griggs decided he needed to go back to his farm in West Tennessee, and the deputy commissioner became the commissioner. It was a gentleman named Bill Walker. He called me in after about 3 months of being commissioner and told me that he thought that men should be over all of the departments. Today I would sue him. That time I just needed a job. I was trying to stay as common. But my last conversation with him, I probably shouldn't even tell you this, but anyway, as I was leaving his office after I had been invited over to have my last discussion with him, he said, Paulette, you need to remember that the Bible says that women are to be in subjection to men. And I said, no, sir, I believe the Bible says that wives are to be in subjection to their husbands, and thank goodness I'm not married to you. And I got up and walked out, and as I said, not one of my finer moments, please. After that, I worked for some... You what?
That's a fine line.
Yeah. After that, I worked for some different not-for-profit organizations, either as executive director or like director of membership or something. And then I was offered a job. In 1992, I went to work for the Tennessee Healthcare Association, which is the Nursing Home Trade Association. And I should have been suspicious when they offered me a lot more money than I had ever been offered at any other not-for-profit in this area. But I took the job, and I got there, and within a week I knew I had made a huge mistake, because the executive director was a crazy man. And he had hired the woman to be the associate director, and she was scared to death of him. So she sat at the front of the building, and she wrote down what time we drove in every morning and came into the building. He was an alcoholic, and he never showed up for work until 2 o'clock. But he wanted us to stay as long as he stayed. So if you got there at 10 minutes after 8, you got called in by Suzanne because you were late. But you didn't dare, if Dick was in the building, not my brother Dick, another Dick, if it was in the building, you didn't leave. If he didn't leave at 8 o'clock, you didn't leave at 8 o'clock. We couldn't go to lunch together. So we would all leave in different cars and go different ways and then go to the same restaurant and talk about them. When I got there, there were 13 employees. When I left 9 months later, there were 13 employees, and 13 employees had turned over during that time. Should have told the board something, but it didn't seem to. So the only good thing that came out of that job was I met a lady named Frieda Herndon. She came to work 2 weeks after I did, came into my office and said, "Have I made the biggest mistake of my life?" I said, "I have." She went to work for Jesse Holman Jones Hospital in Springfield. She lived in Springfield. She called me about 2 weeks later and said, "I gave them your resume." I said, "For what?" And she said, "To be director of home health and hospice." I said, "Frieda, I don't know anything about home health and hospice." And she said, "They think they provide good nursing care, but they don't know whether they're making any money or not." And I told them, "You could figure that out. Will you promise me if they call you, you'll come and at least talk to them?" I said, "I will do that." So I went. They hired me. I drove back and forth from Springfield. They asked me would I move to Springfield, and I told them I would consider it after 6 months. About a year later, my boss said, "I thought you were going to move to Springfield." And I said, "No, I said I would consider it," and I did, and decided not to. And it was there for 3 years. I worked with a consultant from Ernst & Young out of Atlanta, and she called me one day and said, "Send me your resume. I'm working for a company in Knoxville, and they have a job opening, and that's what you need to do to get to the next level." So I sent her my resume. I went and interviewed with a company called Health First out of Knoxville, and they hired me, and I worked for them. I worked for them for 9 years. We were bought 5 times during that time. It was the first time I'd ever heard the term retention bonus. The first time we were bought, they told us if we would stay for 60 days, I think is what it was, or 3 months or something, after the company was bought, that we could... that they would give us a $10,000 retention bonus. And we all just kind of looked at each other and said, we were just hoping we'd have a job, you know. So that's what I did for the next 25 years, and I just realized I've been talking too much, and now I hadn't even gotten to the important part. But I did that for the next 25 years. The rest of my speech, which is as long as what I've already said, maybe I'll come back next week. That's right, part two.
Is that a prequel or a sequel?
I came to Otter Creek, one of the best decisions I ever made. And part of that was that even though I'm single, even though the people that came with me were single, I was never told there's something you can't do. So I've been involved. I taught third and fourth grade girls along with Irene Acuff and Pamela Crosby. I was Miss P. Pamela was Miss P too. We have parents of girls that were in that class. We did lots of things with them. We took them on trips. We hosted Valentine's lunches. We took them on. We would ask for prayer requests, and we prayed for their parents, their brothers and sisters, and the dead cat they saw on the road that morning. Andy Reese wrote on Facebook on Friday, "Every family has secrets until a Sunday school teacher asks a group of kids if they have any prayer requests." And that certainly was true about that class. Give me just a few more minutes and I'll tell you about my family. I have the most phenomenal family of anybody I could ever want. I have one brother who's 2.5 years older than I am, who's always been my best friend. He is married to Vicky. Didn't know whether I was going to like her or not, but he did well. They married. He is a retired orthodontist. They lived in Tullahoma for 45 years. I can't tell you how many trips I've made to Tullahoma in that 45 years. They had trouble having a child, and so they adopted Chambliss. 2 years later, Richard was born. And then Richard started praying for a baby sister. And he would say his prayers every night, and he'd say, God, please give us a baby sister. And Chambliss would say his prayers the next, and he'd say, and God, we don't need a baby sister. Well, Richard went out, and they got a baby sister, Catherine. She's 5.5 years younger than Richard and 7.5 years younger than Chambliss, and they have been her protectors her whole life. My favorite name is being Aunt Polly. Chambliss and Richard both went to school at Lipscomb. Both, after they graduated from Lipscomb and were in Nashville for a while, lived with me. I've always been around I go wherever they go. I'm always included. Chambliss now is married and has 2 children, Tanner and Adeline, and Richard's married and has Burke and Brooks. Catherine married a year ago in December. I married a gentleman, Chris, who has 3 children, so they live in Florida, and she has that. Tanner, my oldest great-nephew, had a problem with his speech and was having a hard time learning to read. And so I said to my brother, hey, I've got, you still make sounds the same way you did 40 years ago when I did this for a living. How about if I come down and work with Tanner some? So I would go to Murfreesboro, and we would do that, and we read books, and and his birthday was 2 weeks ago, and one of the things I gave him was a book. It's a book that you read. It has pages. You turn them. It has chapters. And his mother said to me, Aunt Polly, I never thought I would say that Tanner loves to read. So a few weeks ago, I got a video from Tasha, who is Richard's wife. They have Burke, who is 5, and he's in pre-K, and they have Brooks, who's now 14 months old. It was a video of Burke, and he says, Aunt Polly, I want to learn to read. So he had told Tasha that, and she said, you know, when Tanner was learning to read, Aunt Polly came and helped him. And he said, would she help me? And she said, I bet if she asked, you would. So now I drive to Nolensville about every week or two, and Burke and I have a session. The first time we went, I was showing him, we were doing upper and lowercase letters and sounds of letters and so forth. And he said, Aunt Polly, as he says, I don't want to do this. I want to read a book. And I said, before I leave here today, you will read a book. So I had these little books. It's like at the beach, shells, at the beach, water. So we practiced a couple of times, and he went in and read the book to Mom and Dad. So I'm still going every week or two, and we're advancing in Burke's reading. So I can't leave without telling you about Bailey. Bailey was in my life for 20 years. I met him when Chambliss had a wreck in my car, and I took it to Frank Wilson. I don't know how many of y'all ever took your cars to Frank Wilson down by the fairgrounds. Well, Jim says he did. Except I didn't know Frank Wilson wasn't there anymore. So the guy comes out and he gives me a estimate on my car, and I go and I wait a few days, and I go back, and another gentleman comes out. And I said, I don't think you weren't who I talked to before, and he said, so how much did Beeman tell you? I said, how'd you know I went to Beeman? He says, everybody goes to Beeman. And so he did that, and I told him, the guy told me $500, Beeman told me $880. So Bailey said, so he introduces himself, it's Bailey Heflin. I said, you were at Lipscomb. He said, yeah. When were you there? And I told him, and he said, well, I I talked to during there during that time. So anyway, he told me that he would fix it for five. The deal was he would fix it for $500 because he would honor what the other guy said, even though the other guy didn't work for him and shouldn't have been giving estimates. He would do that, and if he did a good job, I would take him to dinner. And that was the start of a 20-year relationship. So he lost a battle with a horrible disease called amyloidosis last summer. And I've always been asked why we never got married. The day I met him, he told me he'd been married. He didn't do it very well. He didn't ever intend to do it again. So I took him at his word. And he always referred to my friends as the hens and the chicks. So the hens were Mary and Maxine and Bernie and Sue. I hate to tell you, but you were in that group. And then there were some others. And then Jackie and Karen and Cindy and Jan and Pat and Deb and others were the chicks. Jackie always told me she was really glad she made that chicks list. So 2023 was a tough year. I didn't tell y'all about the Yayas, but they were a very special group. Bernie Arnold, Mary Williams, Maxine Bivens, Irene Acuff, and me. We lost Bernie 9 years ago. We lost Mary in January of 23, Irene in October, and Maxine in November. It was a tough year. But between my friends, my family, Jim and Jackie, Deb and Pat, and Jeff, and so many others, I made it through. I'm going to continue to make it through. And I think 2024 is going to be a better year. I will tell you that a few years ago, I told Bailey, I was talking about my mother, or about my grandmother, actually. And I said, my mother always said that my grandmother was a spunky little lady. And I had told him something about my mother, and I just said, my mother always said that my grandmother was a spunky little lady. And I said, I think that describes my mother, too. And he didn't respond. And so I was actually walking away from him. I turned around to look back, and he was just looking at me, and he said, "And you don't think that describes you?" And so I've decided that that's my goal, to make it through 2024 and to be a spunky little lady. So.